Thanks. Hi, everyone. This paper is very much in company with Sam's, which is always a very good feeling. For the last year or so, I've been looking at the relationship between scholarship and conspiracy theory. In particular, I've been interested in the ways that research becomes tied up with different kinds of conspiratorial modes of thought. In a basic sense, I mean the way that research requires special attention to a set of often imperceptible connections that reveal themselves as increasingly relevant, as if they spoke to a larger whole, mostly hidden, glimpsable only by effort. And in another sense, I mean the way that intellectual labour of research is valued in such a way that one form is in constant competition with another, one researcher with another. More and more it feels that scholarship is threatened, not only from outside the research institution, itself now more or less an historical category, but also from within. For these reasons, scholarly work can feel like an exercise in paranoia. So the relationship I'm drawing out here is ambivalent, to do with the sublime emergence of networked thought, as well as with workplace anxiety. My idea is not to fetishize conspiracy theorizing as a cognitive practice, nor to champion paranoia as a work ethic, God no. But what I'm trying to do is work out whether the conspiracy theory as a genre can tell us something about the conditions under which research is done today, and if by thinking with the genre, we can consider the effective, aesthetic, political dimensions of research, a category that for me, and especially today, involves diverse kinds of material conceptual practices that are productive of knowledge. Aesthetic, effective, political dimensions of research that are productive of knowledge. My brackets were too big. At the same time, I've been thinking a lot about writing in contemporary art. I'm trying to imagine a theory that takes writing as a critical material practice in order to move on from the readings dominant in the mid to late 20th century that treat language as material in theories of the expanded art object and or the material as linguistic in expanded notions of the literary. Important as these readings are, they serve to often reinforce historical modes of disciplinarity, showing how, for example, fine arts can read and how the literary arts can look. But thinking about how the process of writing is undertaken in contemporary art and literature requires a rethinking of disciplinary knowledges that have set the terms for engaging with and interpreting language, not least because now, maybe more than ever, it's near impossible to claim or prove a home discipline from which to think and read. I've been thinking of this approach to reading the practice of writing in contemporary art as a kind of poetics, as a way of considering the composition of writing and its contextual livelihood above attempting a single symbolic interpretation. So this paper is the very first go at some of this nascent thinking and what I hope will become a book project in the future. But all this time, I've been misremembering my own title for this conference. I thought and told everyone around me that it was Writing After Poetry. You'll find a much more historical version in the conference program. I like my own misremembering better, so I'm going to stick with it. Writing after poetry is, of course, writing because of and towards and as homage to poetry, as well as in the wake of, following after, coming instead of, or succeeding. Writing after poetry is then writing next to and alongside, writing in the company of what poetry shows up in its particular attention to the coming to form of language. These days I spend my day job and nightlife looking at art, which in Australia and in the emerging experimental scenes, and in a few instances that are of particular interest to me, increasingly looks and feels like poetry, work that's engaged, often explicitly, with the scene of its own making, but in such a manner that it is not merely self-reflexive in this gesture, because an incomprehensibility or unreason is present as a condition of its even having been made. And so the engagement with itself is not neat or resolved or even necessarily particularly revealing. This quality, the attention to the emergence of form in and as a singular work, and then the refusal to resolve the constructive and intelligent irrationality of that attention, is what I perceive as poetic. Or to put it differently, it's what I'm perceiving as initiating or inviting an engagement with poetics. And I'm proposing that this cluster or constellation of artists that I'm particularly interested in, only one of whom I'll talk about today, is tending towards, to cite Sean Bonney, an interruptive and collective poetics in which direct speech and incomprehensibility are only possible as a synthesis. Bonney's idea is of a poetics that can attend to the singularity of political experience alongside and because of the total sociality of politics itself. The interruptive collective gesture is perhaps conspiratorial in the sense that conspiracy finds its critical possibility at the point that the social becomes apparent at a singular moment of exposure. I'm trying to understand this gesture as an ongoing labour in a bigger context in which both poetics and critique are part of a complex system of resistance, but by themselves do not constitute that resistance. So in this paper, I'm going to read the work of Himishi Farah, an artist who lives in Melbourne. I don't know actually if anyone knows Himishi's work. Does anyone here know Himishi's work? Yes, of course. And I'm going to draw a series of relations between Farah's work and some ideas around this interruptive collective poetics. I'm going to try and think whether, using Farah as my first example, an ambivalently conspiratorial labour of scholarly thought can be thought of in the context of contemporary critical art practice in which writing, broadly conceived, is central. In Farah's video work, Marginal Aesthetics, which is on Vimeo, highly recommend it, a voiceover reads text that is also displayed on screen. The image stream varies, moving between cuts of found footage, basic animations, digital effects, video of the artist himself, and install shots from his exhibitions. The text varies too, moving between broader and more local discussions of the concept of the marginal, especially in the way that marginality is commissioned, to use his word, by galleries seeking didactic art in order to be branded as their own institutional critique. Institutional critique, of course, when commissioned by the institution, is a way of both managing and extracting value from its own failure. This regulatory investment in what Farah calls marginal aesthetics serves to keep art that speaks of and to marginality on the margins of contemporary practice. In the video's text, Farah recounts two events at Gertrude Contemporary, a space in Melbourne that he has had a long relationship with. In the first, Farah quotes a former director of Gertrude expressing her satisfaction at being able to, quote, bring the hood into the gallery, end quote, while speaking at an event hosted by Gertrude and engaging the Somali community of Melbourne. And I should also mention here, it's since only a couple of us are familiar with Farah's work, Farah himself is a member of that Somali-Australian community in Melbourne, and this event in particular was not at the gallery space, but was in at an event hosted by the gallery space in the front of a public housing estate in which a lot of this community lives. In the second event, Farah describes a conversation with the current director of Gertrude in which, following Farah's suggestion that the gallery include an acknowledgement of its whiteness in the fine print of an event invitation, the director urged Farah to continue to, quote, critique her institution, end quote, granting him the special responsibility of someone both within and outside welcome in order that his marginality be performed as evidence of Gertrude's self-criticality and therefore ultimately in the consolidation of its institutional value. In his show Pix or It Didn't Happen at Minerva Gallery in Sydney, Farah ran an extension cable across the upper half of the gallery's walls and ceiling in a large loop, leading back down to itself and to a power board hosting five Wi-Fi extenders, each transmitting a unique network. The networks, numbered so as to appear in order and at the top of any list of available connections, together composed a text. Who let the hood into the gallery? This work restages the language of the director's self-congratulatory exclamation as a rhetorical question, speaking back to the claims implicit in her original statement, that is, that it is on her terms that the gallery can finally open itself up, and it is on her terms that the hood can finally find itself in of value and in an art gallery. If a normative liberal idea of progress depends on the expansion of the gallery to include those normally marginalised, then a normative radical position demands that one reject the institution altogether as incapable of progress. Farrar's work makes the point that neither desiring inclusion nor actively excluding oneself from an institution like an art gallery changes the way that institutionality functions, not least of all if you are someone like Farrar, who we can assume actually wants to continue to engage with gallery art. Farrar's question is not whether one ought to, knowing what one knows, be involved in the institution of the art gallery, but what kind of a problem the gallery actually and structurally is to all around it, to those whose access is denied, limited, or exploited, to those whose access is unquestioned or overdetermined, and to those whose absence remains unquestioned, given. In the 20th century, challenging the idea of what the gallery is, its shape, constitution, social makeup, governance, location, content, etc., was of primary interest to artists and critics. Elevating, a word with obvious connotations, non-art to art through the diversification of the gallery was a statement about both value overlooked, anything viewed as art will look back with new promise, and value overdetermined, the gallery therefore produces value rather unnaturally. These two revelations cancel each other out. We can view anything as art, but as soon as we do, we realise that the value of art is an utter sham, in an economic sense. In the 21st century, the inverse seems to be happening too, asking not just what happens to new forms, modes, or subjects when they enter the gallery, but also what happens to the gallery in turn. This has meant understanding that it is the gallery, above all else perhaps, that is revealed by its own transformative processes. Revealed, that is, to be productive of value only in its relation to that which it claims to valuate, and therefore, in a very literal sense, revealing itself to be corrupt. This is, of course, an ambivalent revelation, since the illogic or corruption of value in art is what links art to both the rottenness of economy, broadly speaking, and what makes it exciting in relation to the possibilities of that type of rottenness. In Farrar's practice, there are a number of things going on. In this piece, there are a number of things going on that speak back to this twin history of the gallery and its contents to do with the transformation of the art object. The installation of power leads, adapters, and Wi-Fi extenders on the gallery walls. The visibility of this infrastructure as a nod to process-based, durational, and performative art, for which it is often customary to show that which makes the work possible. And the Wi-Fi signals themselves, present as both a five-line text and the actual stuff, both immaterial and material, of internet connectivity. Reading the work, then, is a matter of processing five signals in the same space via computation, using a phone most likely, in order to arrive at the five lines, who let the hood into the gallery. As a rhetorical question, it's also an accusation. The hood becomes associated with the Wi-Fi signals, since it, in the work's becoming, the five networks are revealed to have entered into the space without notice. Then there is the association of hood and gallery as the two opposed subjects of the phrase, showing in their opposition their relation as terms heavily coded as economically and racially exclusive. Bringing the hood to the gallery, finally, as the director's own language celebrates, is barely different from asking how the hood could get into the gallery in the first place. Reading this work as I would a poem, I read it as engaging not just a critique of the gallery in order to unsettle its terms, though it certainly is that, but also out towards that which lies beyond, to the space of a public or counterpublic who might also find the text embedded in their list of networks, and further still towards the conversations that are possible in the spaces opened up by the ongoing and difficult work of criticality aimed towards the seemingly infinite reproductions of the assumptive and possessive language of hegemony. The question reflects back to the director her own language, yes, but it also poses itself to anyone who reads it and who must consider, by way of a response, their own relation to its terms. I don't have time to talk about these paintings, but I'll just leave them there as visual teasers. The other work I want to discuss is Apologies, which has been exhibited variously, most recently in Hellbroth, a show I curated, co-curated with Vaughan O'Connor at First Draft in Woolmaloo, and which turned on the idea of the list as both a form and method for making and curating. Apologies is an edition of 5 custom-made white T-shirts, each an average size at the neck and bust, but with an extended, excessively long body trailing 4 metres. Farah has exhibited the T-shirt as a single object, as we did in Hellbroth, or as a series with all 5 hung and dangling in the same space. Each T-shirt has a laser-printed image of a continuous stream of tweets. Each tweet, a retweet made from Farah's account and addressed as a reply to him. His tweets are not visible, only the retweeted replies. And each one is an apology from a company, making amends, one assumes, for an error or failure reported in his original tweet. The companies are varied: telecommunications providers, fast food chains, airlines, banks, and so on. And the responses vary too, from generic apologies, "we're sorry to hear this," to more nuanced expressions, "oh no, sounds like we've let you down." The tweets are all different and all identical, in other words. They express regret and invite further dialogue. They perform humanness, though the responses appear and indeed must be standardised. Their delivery indexes a human, sometimes literally with a name or pair of initials, who has personally read and responded to the complaint, levelling the relationship between a consumer and a corporate network as a simple exchange of 2 people in conversation. The publicness of complaints made and replied to on Twitter makes this performance all the more resonant, for it is not just Farah who is to witness the apology, but anyone else who might see the exchange. The apology is at once generic, because it must be able to be sent to anyone in the first instant and as an opening line, because it must be open-ended and vague so as not to admit any guilt. And it must be unique, because the labour cannot be fully automated and because the index of humanness is critical to the performance of care. When I first saw Apologies installed in a different show, I thought how like a poem this is. Not only for its list-like repetitious rhythm or its collage effect or its accidental composition or its automated lineations, all things we might associate with various compositional modes and styles in collagist, procedural or chance-based poetries, but mostly because of the way that the language, collated without intervention, exposes its artificiality. The work is not only an exposé of the commonness of bare minimum corporate customer service, not only a meditation on the difference and sameness of cultural expressions of mild sorriness, not only a compelling object whose unnatural scale matches the absurd feed of solicited apologies. It's all these things and something else too, a study in the naturalisation of certain speech acts, those speech acts that form relationships between a subject and the world in which subjectivation occurs. If a conventional idea of the lyric poem understands the speaker as addressing a world that is both the object and witness of address, an alternative approach reads the lyric as a form of address in which difference and distance function as critical interventions into the very ideas of speech, address, and witness. The lyric is read as articulating the social, political, and affective dimensions of experience that, despite efforts otherwise and despite the intimacy of such efforts, remain difficult to cohere or express. I read Farah's Apologies as a version of this alternative lyric, a poem that, to return again to Bonnie, is interruptive and collective, gesturing to both the singularity and mediatedness of experience. When I read it like this as a poem, recalling as I do the many resonance this work has with contemporary work, contemporary poetics, I ask myself the simple and obvious question: why is the poem printed on a T-shirt as opposed to being collated in a PDF format, published as a one-off perfect-bound artist book, or kept in its first context as a project dedicated Twitter feed? The fact that it is a T-shirt makes the reading experience rather singular. One stands head up or down or craned in, negotiating the fall and sway of a cotton tube in an exhibition space. One becomes, of course, part of what is exhibited and therefore observable about the work. One understands one's reading as an important gesture of the work's invitation. Perhaps one feels more conscious of reading as a result. A long T-shirt is a sort of ready-made, a gesture of good faith absurdity. The shirt is an unwearable wearable, an object made dysfunction by its incapacity to know its own limits. And as such, it's a poem infinitely more readable than if it were published as a book, since it's double decommission, its length plus its status as an exhibited artwork, serves to amplify twice over its capacity to be read. We cannot wear it, and so we read it. And we read it because our desire to wear a 4-metre-long shirt becomes a desire to register the full extent of its inhospitable length. I've ended up here with a lot of different concepts in play. Conspiracy and its relation to scholarly labour, a poetics of interruptive collectivity, writing as a practice in the space of contemporary art, and the difference between criticality and the political as a definite quality of this or that work. If it seems like a hard task to bring this all together, that's because it is. This paper is only the first attempt to think these things through. Reading Farah's work, I'm thinking of his use of language as part of an ongoing, precarious conversation that registers the intensity of political life without fixing the political in an object or image. His language hangs, unresolved, ambiguous, ambivalent, a challenge in excess of an applied ethic as the answer to its own line of questioning. His language retains the index of its making, the voice of the curator, the voice of the corpse, sorry bot, and then, vitally, the voice of critique, the voice of the questions that remain unanswered. In its explicit madeness, this language becomes its own poetics of inquiry, the admission of the labour that never ends, the writing through of criticality, the tracing of the relations that single things out and group them together, and the pointing to the holes through which the same is threaded over and again, and through which a hand can sometimes pass, tugging as if at a loose thread. Thanks.